Today at Reader's Corner, Nathan Thrall, author of the new book, A Day in the Life of Abd Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In his latest book, A Day in the Life of Abd Salama, Nathan Thrall tells the story of a father's desperate hunt to find his son, Malad, a victim of a school bus accident, a task compounded by the maze of physical, emotional, and bureaucratic obstacles he must navigate because of one fact: he is Palestinian. Nathan Thrall is the author of The Only Language They Understand, Forcing Compromise in Israel and Palestine. His essays, reviews, and reported features have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Guardian, the New York Review of Books, and have been translated into more than a dozen languages. Nathan Thrall, welcome to Reader's Corner, all the way from Jerusalem.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Nathan, we're not giving anything away by kicking this off with your description of what happened on February 16th, 2012, a rainy Thursday morning in the Palestinian territory just outside of Jerusalem. And once you give the basics of the accident, then I'd like to go one by one through a series of issues that contributed to the accident, as you say, the true origins of the calamity. But let's begin. What happened on that day?
So the accident originated from a school in the town of Anata, which is partially annexed by Israel. So it lies within the Jerusalem municipal boundary and is considered part of the sovereign state of Israel. And part of it is unannexed. And this school is in the unannexed part of Anata, considered, you know, the West Bank. And the main character of the book, Abd Salama, had a five-year-old son in kindergarten in this school, together with a bunch of other students who lived in this community, which is entirely walled off on three sides by a 26-foot tall concrete wall, and on a fourth side by a different kind of wall that runs through a segregated road, Route 4370, covered widely in the press and often referred to as the apartheid road, because it has traffic for Israelis on one side and Palestinians on the other. Milad, Abed's son, was very excited for this school trip in this walled enclave that he lives in and which the school is located. There are no playgrounds. There are hardly any paved roads. The streets have no sidewalks. People are forced to burn trash in the middle of the street because they receive so few municipal services. And when the school decided to do a trip for the kindergartners at a play area, they were forced to leave this community and go quite a distance along the route of the wall to the outskirts of Ramallah. And they passed through a checkpoint in the rain that morning. And about a minute after passing through this checkpoint, they were struck by a giant semi-trailer. The bus flipped over and caught fire, and six children and one teacher died. And the ones who were left there to help rescue the children were the bystanders on the side of the road, the Palestinians who lived in that area. And this is a very complex geography where some Palestinians have green West Bank IDs, which prevent them from entering any part of Jerusalem, either occupied East Jerusalem or West Jerusalem. And others have blue IDs that permit them to enter Jerusalem. And the parents of the kids on the school bus also had a mixture of green and blue IDs. You know, it was common to have a mixture of these kinds of permits within the same family. And so the bystanders who were at the scene, they would go off in different directions depending on the color of ID that they had. So if you were a bystander and you pulled over at the side of the road seeing the school bus in flames and somebody handed you a soot-covered five-year-old, you would go, if you had a blue ID that permitted you to enter Jerusalem, you would go to the superior hospitals in Jerusalem that were very close by. And if you had a green ID, you would go in the opposite direction in your car, most of them to the hospital in Ramallah. And when Abed found out about the accident and rushed with other parents to the scene, by the time he got there, all of the kids had been evacuated by these bystanders. And Abed asked the crowd where the children were. He couldn't see a single child there. And he was told many different things, that they were at a hospital in West Jerusalem, they were at a different hospital in East Jerusalem, they were at the Israeli military base 1 minute up the road, they were at the Ramallah hospital. And because Abed himself had a green West Bank ID, he wasn't able to go look for his son at most of those places. He couldn't go to the hospitals in Jerusalem, he certainly couldn't go to the Israeli military base. And so he went to the Ramallah hospital and searched for his son there and couldn't find him. He called on relatives who did have blue IDs to go look for his son in the Jerusalem hospitals. And the book follows his journey of over 36 hours to find out what happened to his son. And through that journey and through the stories of some of the emergency responders and teachers and parents, the founder of the Israeli settlement just next to the accident site, the Israeli colonel who created the wall that shaped so much of what transpired on that day, we learn the broader story of Israel-Palestine.
Well, what is the basis of the distinction between the blue and the green cards? Why do some people have one and some have others?
Blue IDs are given to those who live in the territory that Israel has formally annexed. So it's all part of the West Bank. It was all conquered by Israel in 1967, but only a portion of it over the lands of over a couple dozen villages in the Jerusalem area were annexed. So the heart of East Jerusalem was annexed, and so were the lands of these more than two dozen villages. And those areas are now considered to be part of the sovereign state of Israel, and Israel gave the residents their blue ID cards that permit them to travel inside Israel and to cross between the different parts of Jerusalem, those that are on one side of this concrete wall and those that are on the other, and to go wherever they'd like in the West Bank. And other people who live maybe in the same village, but not in the part of it that was annexed, would have a green ID, as do the vast majority of the residents of the West Bank.
Well, this little boy, Milad, who was on that bus that day, he was attending this particular private school. What kind of school were these children attending? And most importantly, why?
Well, the enclave that these people live in, this walled area that consists of Anata, both the annexed and unannexed parts of Anata, as well as the Shuafat refugee camp, a refugee camp in the municipal boundary of Jerusalem that contains the refugees and their descendants of the 1948 war. This community has about 130,000 people in it today, and about half of it is considered municipal Jerusalem, where people have blue IDs, and another half is considered the unannexed West Bank. And all of East Jerusalem is subject to gross neglect, the Palestinian areas of East Jerusalem, not the Jewish settlements within it. And the areas that are most neglected are those that are on the other side of this concrete wall. And the area that is inside this enclave has so few municipal services, so few schools. There's a single municipal school in a former goat pen. The parents didn't want to send their children, if they could avoid it, through this checkpoint every morning to get to the other side of the wall, to get to the main schools that they could go to in Jerusalem. Even those schools on the other side were so overcrowded. You had schools doing double shifts because there was a shortage of thousands of classrooms for Palestinians in East Jerusalem. And the parents who could afford it would send their kids to a private school within the same enclave that's in the West Bank. And that was this school that this accident took place in. It was called Nur al-Huda. And the students there were, a large number of them were actually Jerusalem residents who were forced to go to school, to a private school in the West Bank.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Nathan Thrall, author of the new book, A Day in the Life of Abd Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. So what role does the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine play in Abd's young life, who would later become the father of Malad? How long was he imprisoned and for what crime?
Abd was imprisoned for being a member of the DFLP, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, during the First Intifada, which was the 1987 to 1993 uprising against Israeli occupation. You know, the first two decades of Israeli occupation of Gaza and the West Bank from 1967 to 1987 was fairly easy for Israel. It was largely quiescent. And this 1987 uprising really took Israel by surprise and changed its thinking about how it would rule the occupied territories. Abd was fresh out of high school, and he had a older brother-in-law who was a local leader of the Democratic Front, who recruited him to join the Democratic Front and to distribute leaflets and to paint graffiti on the walls. They would paint the actual contents of these leaflets with instructions for protesters of where to go, what areas to avoid, what stores to boycott, what products to boycott. And Abd and his brother-in-law both were arrested. Abd was tortured and sent to a number of different prisons, including one that was at a military base on his family's land, just across the road from where he grew up, and eventually was sent to a prison not that far from Gaza in the Negev desert. And when he came out, his brother-in-law was still in jail, and he became the local leader of the Democratic Front.
While we're on the subject of prisons and torture, you have a character in your book here who is actually a doctor. She is one of the first to arrive at the scene of this accident. She has a son, and you depart from the story of the accident to tell her son's story. He's a young boy. He's either a teen or a preteen, and apparently these Palestinian kids will sometimes throw rocks at the armored tanks that are moving by. Tell us what happens to them as a result of that.
So the mother you're referring to, who helped rescue many of the children from the bus that morning, her name is Huda Dahbour. And she's a doctor who works for the UN Refugee Agency, just happened to be with her medical team on her way to work when she came upon this burning bus. And in the book, I tell the story of her return to Palestine, her return to the West Bank after her family had been forced to flee Haifa in 1948. She grew up in a refugee camp in Syria and eventually married a Palestinian diplomat, which enabled her to come back to the West Bank, unlike most Palestinian refugees, during the Oslo period. And she raised her children in the area just outside of Jerusalem. And her young son, Hadi, was sent to a new school as restrictions on movement increased for Palestinians, and she could no longer send Hadi to a school within municipal Jerusalem. And at this new school, which was in Abu Dis, Hadi started to make a new set of friends, and he started to be harassed with his friends at this school by Israeli soldiers who were patrolling the area constantly. It's where Al-Quds University is. There were it was a site of frequent clashes with the army. And the boys in the school were regularly harassed before and after school, and they started to throw stones at the soldiers like other older boys did in this area. And they would cover their faces when they did it. And Huda would sometimes be in the area and see her son throwing stones and look at this with dread, because she knew that it meant that her son could be taken from her in the middle of the night. And that's exactly what happened. One night at about 1:30 in the morning, some jeeps pulled up, and there was loud slamming of against her door, and she came down and answered the door, and they said, "We've come for Hadi," and they refused to tell her what he was being charged with, why they were taking him, where they were taking him to. She had tears streaming down her face as she led the soldiers up to Hadi's bedroom. She was afraid to give him a hug goodbye, even as he was leaving, fearing that any kind of movement could provoke the soldiers and he could wind up getting shot, or she could. And he was taken away. It took her more than a week of searching. She had special access because she worked for the UN Refugee Agency, so she could look in other places that, and access places that other Palestinians couldn't. And she eventually looked at a number of different detention facilities and found her adolescent son, and attended his trial. He was sentenced to over a year in prison. And when he came into the courtroom, she saw that he had marks on him. And she demanded that he raise his shirt and show the courtroom that he had been tortured. And he did so. And she refused the judge's instruction not to come up and hug her son. She ran over and hugged Hadi. And he was taken away also to a prison in the Negev desert. That year for Huda was the most difficult of her life. And she's still traumatized by this year of separation from her son, and believes that it changed him forever.
Well, that changing him forever is the whole point the reader walks away with here, because it just sounds like manufactured terrorism when you start throwing kids in prison for such minor crimes. But let's get back to the accident. You describe the roads getting to and from the accident as substandard, to say the least, with what you call suffocating traffic as emergency vehicles were attempting to get back and forth from the accident. The rain made the roads even worse, I suppose. There were Palestinian requests to improve the roadways. What was the nature of those requests, and how were they answered?
The Palestinians had repeatedly requested that there be lights installed on this road and a divider put within it, because the road where the accident took place was carved through a small mountain. And so it's like a giant tunnel with this rocky cliff on each side of it. And there were checkpoints at either end of this stretch of the road. And people, Palestinians, it was really a road that at this point was used almost entirely by Palestinians. It had originally been created for Israeli settlers. And they would sit in traffic sometimes for hours at the Kalandia checkpoint. And finally, when they would get around it, they would be on this stretch of road just for a short while before reaching a second checkpoint, the Jaba checkpoint. And all kinds of cars would pass one another. Everybody was late and in a rush. You know, such a theme of life for Palestinians in the West Bank is the feeling that their time has been stolen, that they have no control over their own schedules and lives, which are so unpredictable just because of, you know, getting from A to B can take 15 minutes or it can take several hours. And so cars would pass one another in the lane of opposing traffic, and there were many accidents on this road. It was referred to as the death road even before this accident took place on it. And the Palestinian authorities requests they have no jurisdiction over this road. This road is in Area C, which is the more than 60% of the West Bank that's under full Israeli, not just security control, but administration. And Israel had refused those requests.
So how far away was the nearest Israeli ambulance and emergency services, and what was the response time by them to this accident?
So the, you know, I won't recall exactly in terms of distance as the crow flies, but there was an Israeli checkpoint just a minute away from the accident site. People, bystanders, who actually ran to the checkpoint and begged the soldiers there to come and help. They refused. There was an Israeli military base just a minute up the road in the other direction. There was an Israeli fire station in the East Jerusalem settlement of Pisgat Ze'ev, very close to the accident site. And there were fire trucks at a settlement just north of the accident site as well. It was more than 30 minutes before the first Israeli fire truck arrived. And by that time, all of the children had been evacuated, just in private cars. And the parents who lost children or who had children who were injured in this accident, something every single one of them pointed out to me was that when children, Palestinian children, throw stones on this very same road, it is a minute or 2 minutes before an Israeli border police or regular police or army jeep shows up to arrest those kids. And here we had a bus that was burning, and it took over half an hour before the first fire trucks came.
Let's talk about this truck that was barreling down the road. How much responsibility lies with the driver and the owners of this bus company?
You know, that there was utter negligence on the part of the driver. Yeah. He was a resident of Abed's community. He grew up across the street from Abed, and he was driving at roughly twice the speed limit on a very, very stormy morning. With terrible rain and wind, he had not been properly trained on the use of this semi-trailer, and it seems very likely that he misapplied a braking device that caused the bus to skid out and slam into the school bus that was in opposing traffic, causing that school bus to flip over. The driver, you know, bears great responsibility for the utter negligence that led to this accident.
Nathan, you report on a TV crew showing up at Abed's home a month after the accident. Tell us what they wanted to cover in the interview with Milad's father.
So the journalist, a man named Arik Weiss, was a TV journalist. He grew up actually not that far from the accident site in an East Jerusalem settlement. And he was considered a center-left journalist. Right-wing politicians would sometimes refuse to appear if he was the interviewer. And he was horrified by the response that he saw from Israelis to the accident itself. On the day of the accident, there were articles on Israeli news sites, and there were posts on Facebook and social media about the accident. And all kinds of Israelis were posting jubilantly about the deaths of these kindergartners, celebrating their deaths. And what was most shocking to this Israeli journalist was that they were doing it without pseudonyms. They weren't hiding in any way. They didn't feel that there was a need to hide this joyous celebration of the deaths of innocent kindergartners because they were Palestinian. And so he decided to create a TV special, not about the accident so much as the Israeli reaction to it. And he found some of these people who were posting in celebration, many of them young, all of the ones he interviewed, I believe, were young, in celebration of the deaths of these kindergartners. And then he went and he found some of the settlers who lived right next to Abed's community of Anata, one of them in a settlement, Anatot, that is on the lands of Anata. And he brought these settlers with him to Abed's home and allowed them, gave them the opportunity to express their condolences and also to tell Abed that they had absolutely nothing to do with these horrible Facebook posts and comments on news articles, and that the members of their communities didn't wish any ill on these residents of Anata and on their children. And Abed and his brother, you know, received the settlers in their home and very graciously and accepted their condolences and listened to what they said. But it was a very forced and awkward encounter.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Nathan Thrall, author of the new book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama. The book tells the story of a deadly accident outside Jerusalem that unravels a tangle of lives, loves, and histories over the course of a single day. So how did the father of Milad, Abed, finally become convinced that his son had died in this accident?
Well, late in the afternoon of the day of the accident, he started to see other parents bring their children who weren't seriously injured home. And there were very few parents left who hadn't located their children. And a doctor came out and told some of the parents there who still hadn't located their children that there were some severely burned children in the morgue just within the hospital. And he asked Abed, "What color is your son's hair?" And Abed said, "Blonde." And the doctor said, "The child who is too badly burned to be identified in the other room has brown hair." So he selected a different parent to go in and look, and this father came out. Apparently he wasn't so badly burned, he couldn't be identified. The father came out shouting and hitting himself. And Abed was then asked to give blood. He called his wife and Milad's older brother, who was about 9 at the time, and they came and gave blood. And Abed, to this day, you know, he can't forget the look that his son, his 9-year-old boy, gave him. It felt like a look of blame, like, what have you allowed to happen to my younger brother? And they took the family's blood and they sent them home. And they went home that evening still having no idea, but, you know, obviously, it was looking increasingly likely that they were going to receive news that Milad was dead. They held out hope that he was still alive. There were rumors that other parents hadn't found their children yet, that some kids were taken by some of these bystanders to their homes. And they still clung to hope until the next day, when Abed's relative, who worked in the Palestinian Authority, called and told them in the afternoon that they had received the results of the DNA test. They had to send them to an Israeli facility to have them processed. And Milad was, in fact, one of the children who had been in this room next to Abed that whole day. Yeah.
Nathan, sum this up for us. Of course, there was a driver who was driving too fast, and we can account for his liability. But But it goes much deeper than this, and you close your book with some final comments that I think our listeners ought to hear.
You know, the writer David Foster Wallace gave a famous graduation speech where he told an anecdote about fish swimming past one another, and one fish says to the other, water's nice today. And the other fish replies, what's water? And one of the themes of this book is the extent to which everybody takes this system of control, the segregation of the Palestinian communities from the Jewish ones, for granted. That there is a walled enclave that exists only because the municipal authorities and the Israeli government authorities wanted to push as many Palestinians as possible outside of the center of the city without relinquishing much land. And everyone takes this entire logic of segregation for granted. They take for granted the utter neglect of these people on the other side of the wall, the fact that they have no municipal services while paying taxes to the Israeli Jerusalem municipality, the fact that emergency services will be held at a checkpoint and not be permitted to enter unless they have an army escort, the fact that all of these hundreds of thousands of people on the other side of the wall are living this radically different existence from the Israeli Jews living right beside them. And the real, you know, aim of this book was to show through this accident how this entire system of control operates, how it shapes every day of these people's lives, how it shaped the life of this mother, Huda, and creating the worst year of her life, how it forced Abed at one point to even choose a marriage partner based on the color of her ID, just so he could retain his higher paying job in Jerusalem. This entire system is really the deeper subject of this book. And we see how it works by watching these people navigating this system, these parents navigating this system on the worst day of their lives.
Well, we've all but run out of time, but I do want to ask you one other question, and I'll figure out some way to fit it in. You did an interview with The Guardian, Nathan, about your book, and the headline of that review that The Guardian did reads, "It's Lonely Being a Jewish Critic of Israel," and the subheadline read, "As the Israel-Hamas War Escalates, the U.S. author says his book tour is fraught with the possibility of misunderstanding." How are things going in that regard, and has anything changed since then?
I think things have changed a little bit. In the immediate aftermath of the October 7th attack and the beginning of this war, it was very difficult to talk about the lives of Palestinians under occupation. There were many people who felt that discussing this decades-long system of control was some sort of justification for the October 7th attack. There was all kinds of just extreme polarization where people felt incapable of expressing grief for both Israelis and Palestinians in the early weeks of this war. And to some extent, that still exists. And for those people, it's been difficult to talk to them about the subject of this book. But I do feel that there has been an increased yearning to understand the roots of this conflict, to understand why we see these perpetual rounds of violence. And, you know, that's one of the aims of this book, is to explain the system as it exists, whether we're in a round of violence or not, and what is actually driving all of this bloodshed. Mm-hmm.
Well, you've done a masterful job with that. And if any of our listeners would want to put face with names, I must say that the New York Times book review of your book has a beautiful photo of a beautiful little 8-year-old boy, Milad, with his older brother, Adam. And it just makes your heart sink when you look at that and think how this whole thing turned out. But we do hope that your book plays a role in bringing people together. Nathan Thrall, author of A Day in the Life of Abd Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much for having me, Bob.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.